Are you ready?
Yes.
Good morning, Ms. Walker.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Jose Ayers. The trial court committed two reversible errors in this case. The first one was permitting the state to introduce an incriminating statement made by Mr. Ayers after he was in custody and after he had invoked his rights under Miranda. Second reversible error occurred when the trial court allowed the state to present evidence of Mr. Ayers' use of racial epithets. On October 2nd, 2005, Mr. Ayers was taken into custody for the shootings of his wife and the shootings of Mr. Allen Davis, who actually subsequently died. He was interviewed or attempted to be interviewed by Detective Smith. He invoked his Miranda rights. Smith then took him to booking to Officer Kraft, told Officer Kraft that he actually had invoked, and then the officer began the processing. During processing, however, Kraft testified that during processing, in order to relax Ayers, he asked him about his kids, if he had any kids. However, the officer also testified that Mr. Ayers was not tense and was fully cooperative. When he asked about his kids, Mr. Ayers responded, "I don't want to bring my family into this," and then subsequently indicated how his reaction, what happened that night with respect to the shooting.
On that subject, is it a fair statement of the issue, at least as to your first claim of error, that that is the issue is whether or not it was foreseeable to someone in the position of the police officer that asked the question that that it would lead to an incriminating response?
I think that is actually important to this case.
Well, is it a fair statement of the issue?
That's part of the issue. Let me explain. In Wainwright versus State, this court showed that reading the charges was okay, but explaining the evidence was not okay, and the defendant responded to that. So the reason I hesitate on that a little bit is whether it was foreseeable in that case for the officers to realize that he would then incriminate himself is questionable. However, in response to your question directly, with respect to the circumstances of this case, it was foreseeable that it would solicit incriminating response. And that,
well, that's your argument.
Yes.
Is the issue, the key issue, whether or not an incriminating response was foreseeable?
The key issue is whether the police officer initiated contact with the defendant for communication purposes beyond pedigree information after Mr. Ayers invoked his rights.
Well, that if that's the issue, it sort of puts the rabbit in the hat, doesn't it? That is the question. You know, not strictly speaking a pedigree question, but was designed or was intended to facilitate the answer to a pedigree question. At least that's what the record seems to show.
Well,
but if it isn't a pedigree question, then according to the way you framed the issue, the state loses.
Right.
But if this officer and if any reasonable officer who was asking that question would have had no reason to suspect that it would trigger an incriminating response, then there would have been no Miranda violation. Isn't that correct?
There would have been. Maybe I'm misunderstanding. He invoked, it was clear to Officer Kraft that he invoked.
He invoked his Miranda rights. He gave an incriminating response in response to a question.
Correct.
The only issue is, was the question of a kind that would have, that should have been expected to provoke an incriminating response. If that's not a fair statement of the issue, tell me why not.
Well, it is important. I'm not going to argue that it wasn't designed to elicit the response. I think what the court is indicating that under Edwards, the police have to reinitiate the contact after the defendant has invoked in order for it to be a violation. Under the Pennsylvania versus Munez, it states that booking questions are acceptable unless they are likely to elicit incriminating information.
And that's the rule that governs these facts, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, then, again, I'll ask you, doesn't the whole claim, at least your first claim, come down to whether or not a person in the police officer's position should have foreseen that an incriminating response would be triggered by the question, do you have children or kids?
That would be fair, Your Honor. I tend to disagree with that because I think Edwards and Oregon versus Bradshaw extends it a little more broadly when the individual has already invoked the right. But assuming that it is essential and that the officer has to have been reasonably foreseeable for the officer that it would solicit an incriminating response, I'd say that was the case here. Because you have to look at the context of the circumstances. Here, the officer, first of all, knew that he had invoked. Secondly, the officer knew this was a domestic violence case and was asking him about his children. What's more significant is that he stated that he did this to relax Mr. Ayers, but also stated he wasn't tense.
Why is that significant? Is there a factual dispute here?
No, I think
so. I mean, it's undisputed that the officer testified, and I take it from that, believed that he was asking this question in order to relax the defendant.
There's no dispute that he testified to that, but there's also no dispute that he testified that Mr. Ayers was not tense. So my point is that lends some credibility to the theory that he knew that when he'd ask a question like this, when it wasn't necessary, that it was likely to. It was a gratuitous question, I guess is what I'm saying. And in Wainwright, the reading explaining the evidence was gratuitous as well. The other significant thing here is once he began to incriminate himself, the officer then didn't either re-Mirandize him or remind him that he did not have to talk to him. And that was certainly, he was certainly in the position to do that, having known that he had invoked his rights.
Well, if you could apply that argument, I suppose, across the board. Let's assume, for example, that the officer asked a question that under no circumstances would reasonably foreseeably trigger an incriminating response, and yet
Correct.
It does. Is it your position that even in those circumstances, the officer would have to stop the defendant from talking and re-Mirandize him?
I believe so. That would be my position. So it would be a couple layers there. That once he started incriminating, after the police officer initiated the contact, even if the court were to find that was not foreseeable, that it would elicit an incriminating response, the fact that he gave a lengthy statement. So at any time, the officer could have said, I know you invoked your rights. Let me explain to you what the consequences of this is. You'd be waiving your rights.
So is that why you appear to be taking the position that the foreseeability of an incriminating response is not the pivotal issue?
Correct. I would argue an alternative argument, I guess, that first, if it was likely foreseeable, therefore he shouldn't have asked the question. Even if it was not foreseeable to elicit an incriminating response, once he started providing incriminating information, he should have then reminded him that he was waiving the rights he had previously invoked.
Is that argument set forth in your brief? That latter argument?
I think that it's all the argument. I do mention that he should have re-Mirandized him, and that it was a booking.
It isn't elevated to the level of an argument heading, isn't it? Is it?
It's not a heading, no, Your Honor. I think it's one combined argument that he should have re-Mirandized him because what he asked was a gratuitous question that was not essential to booking. Therefore, because it was not essential to booking, and he initiated the contact, and that's clearly set out in the brief, that he initiated the contact, and because it was a gratuitous question, not essential to booking, he therefore, the answer to the question was inadmissible. That as factual basis is set out in the brief, yes.
All right, now I'm confused. let's assume for the moment that the officer was getting fingerprints or whatever he was doing and didn't say a word to him. and your client started talking after he had been, you know, he had invoked. And is it your position that there is some authority for the proposition that the police officer at that point had to say, well, wait a second, don't forget you invoked. Are you sure you want to talk to me?
Right.
Would there be such a requirement under any case law?
Your Honor, in Oregon versus Bradshaw, the United States Supreme Court stated that once a defendant expresses his desire to deal only with police through an attorney, counsel must be made available to him unless the defendant initiates further communication, exchanges, or conversations. So in your scenario, the defendant would have initiated it, therefore it would be a different circumstance than in our case.
Okay, so what you're saying is that even if the initial question was determined not to be one that would be reasonably foreseeable, would result in an incriminating statement, the fact that any statement whatsoever, any question, you know, do you know what today's date is? Answer, I didn't mean to kill him, you know, whatever. So regardless of how far off the question might have been, if the question was asked and if a statement was given that was incriminating in response to that question, then because this person had invoked previously, then it would be incumbent, it would be required that the police stop the person from speaking and re-advise him of his Miranda rights.
I believe that would be a fair reading of Wainwright versus State, where the police officers did not even ask a question after he had invoked. They had said, here are your charges. Oh, and by the way, this is the evidence we have of the charges. Then 40 minutes later, the defendant said, you know what, I did it, or whatever he said. And in that case, it was found to be reversible error. And I think that's similar to our case. This was a gratuitous question that was initiated by the police after he had invoked.
That sort of removes from the unit, but basically eliminates the concept of a voluntary statement, doesn't it? Except in the narrow circumstances where the initiation is entirely spontaneous on the part of the defendant, as opposed to being triggered by a question, any question, foreseeable, that had a foreseeable consequence or not.
Well, I think there's, I'm not going to say apples and oranges, but I think when you're dealing with no Miranda, when there's no Miranda, the voluntariness is significant. Under Edwards versus Arizona, once an individual has invoked Miranda, we're in a different set of circumstances. So,
a fair point. But once Miranda is invoked, aren't you essentially arguing that the concept of a voluntary statement drops out in almost every case?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. The second issue where the trial court erred in this case was permitting the use of evidence that Mr. Ayers used the racial epithet. This court has held that the injection of race into a criminal trial is unacceptable, and it impugns the Equal Protection Clause, which requires that race not be properly injected into a fair trial.
Well, that's not exactly what we said. We said you can't inject it without a factual basis.
Improperly, correct.
Correct. And we didn't discuss the Equal Protection Clause because we were talking about the state constitution, at least in Weddington. And the argument in this case is that there was a factual basis. As I understood your argument, either it wasn't relevant to the charge or it was unfairly prejudicial and should have been excluded under the balancing test.
Correct. First, Your Honor, respectfully, I would state there was a quote in Weddington regarding the Equal Protection Clause. I do know that the court made its decision on the Delaware Constitution. And then the court's next point is correct. It's admissible if it's relevant to intent and motive. Here, it was not relevant to that. First of all, Mr. Ayers was arguing extreme emotional distress. So there was no dispute as to intent. And, in fact, the defense counsel acknowledged that in her opening statement. More significantly, the state was not arguing the motive was racial animus. The state argued, and this state in its response brief acknowledges that throughout its opening statement, throughout its closing argument, it nowhere mentioned racial animus as the reason for the motive. The only thing that became significant in this case was whether he was in a frenzied state of mind or calm and deliberate, which is what the statement, for the Miranda statement, goes to support that, whereas whether he said these words or not wasn't relevant to that in this case. So unlike Zabrowski, also the defense asserted makes a significant difference. In Zabrowski, the court was dealing with a defense that was an accident, so they had to show intent. And same thing in Duanolo, it was a total denial by the defendant. What I would say is that this is more similar to Flautiotis. In that case, the defendant and the victim were both white, so the court said, well, race wasn't important. Although, in this case, my client was Filipino and the victim was African-American, race was still not an issue here. So there was no need for that to be brought up four different times. And in fact, Ms. Van Amerogen objected for pages, I think, in the brief, at the trial, indicating that the tape should not have been admitted after the fact. She had not heard it, even though she diligently looked at it, and then arguing that Rose should not have been able to testify to it three separate times. She testified when the state asked her, she testified that he was out of control, cursing and yelling, and then the prosecutor stepped back and asked her specifically to state those words that he said. And that wasn't necessary because race was not an issue. It was never an issue. They said he was jealous and controlling, and he came home and she was in bed with another man in his house. Therefore, that was his motive. So it was completely irrelevant. And if there's any marginal relevance, it's completely outweighed by the inflammatory nature, and I would suggest that nobody in this room would dispute the fact that in the English language, that is probably the most inflammatory word. And further, the trial court refused to give an instruction, cautionary instruction. The court said, I'm not going to give an instruction because I'd have to tell them it goes to state of mind. And if I tell them it goes to state of mind, that's harmful. But that was the reason he found it to be relevant. So the jury was left with the ability to use it for whatever reason it wanted. And that's in the appendix at A55A, and I also discussed that in the reply brief. So in a couple of cases where jurisdiction said that it's not reversible error for the use of this word, even though there's marginal error, because the court gave an admonishment to the jury, it wasn't reversible. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. May it please the court. I'll begin with the appellant's first argument, the statements that were that took place by Mr. Aries during the booking process by Corporal Kraft. There's certainly no question that Mr. Aries had invoked Miranda. That Corporal Kraft was aware of the Miranda invocation, and obviously by being at the police station, he was physically in police custody. So therefore, the issue here is whether the statement, and I'll paraphrase, so do you have any children, is the functional equivalent of interrogation.
Well, that's one way to frame it. The other part of it is, or likely to provoke an incriminating response. It could be either one, right? Even if it wasn't the functional equivalent of interrogation, if it was likely to provoke an incriminating response, it was also improper.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. And the state is not asking this court to say that as a matter of law, in any case, that it would be appropriate for a police officer to say, so do you have any kids? But in this specific case, it was certainly not likely to It should not. A reasonable officer would not have known that it's likely to prompt discussion about the case.
Well, help me understand that in the context of this case. You agree that Officer Kraft read the charges before he asked that question. Is that correct?
Yes. I don't believe it was immediately beforehand, but yes.
He had read them. So he read something to the effect, I want you to know, Mr. Ayers, that you're being charged with murdering your coworker, Mr. Davis, and you're also being charged with attempting to murder your wife. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then a little while later, he says, oh, and do you have any children? Now, in thinking about that, you know, one answer is obviously, yes, I have three children. The other possibility is he would say, oh, my God, what have I done? I've ruined my life. I've ruined the wife of my children's mother. What's going to happen to my children? And there could have been a lot of reactions other than simply, oh, yeah, by the way, I do have three children, and that's right, I did just attempt to kill their mother while I was killing my coworker. Isn't it logical to assume when someone's being charged with killing their wife that if you start asking them about their children, it might invoke an emotional response?
Your Honor, I can understand how that might be a possibility, but that's not, in fact, what was going on in this case.
No, but isn't it a probability? That may not be the answer, but my question is just, you know, in trying to apply a precedent to future cases, if you're charged with attempting to murder your spouse, isn't it probable that after someone has invoked their Miranda rights and you ask them about their children, they're going to express something that's emotional, probably?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I can concede that that's going to be probable. I'll concede that is a possibility, but not specifically in this case. Officer Kraft testified, and Superior Court did make findings of fact, that this was done to relax him. And the big kind of semantics, I'll call it, in the briefing is whether there's a difference between whether someone is relaxed and whether they're cooperative.
Tell us the rationale for asking someone about their children who's charged with murder and attempting to murder the children's mother. How does striking up a conversation about the children of the woman you just tried to murder help relax you?
Your Honor, at the point in the process where we are, when this statement comes up, some of the biographical information has already been entered for the processing for JP Court. Now Corporal Kraft is taking Mr. Ayers for the actual fingerprinting. And at this point,
Now my question, you know, just try to answer it directly. You know, I could see, for example, if you said, do you like something in the abstract? Do you like painting? What are your hobbies? Things like that, you know, might relax a person. But my question specifically is, how does asking about the children of the woman you just tried to murder help relax you?
Your Honor, certainly in hindsight, it's not going to be the most relaxing thing to talk about. If an officer... The state would argue, though, that in this case, it's more similar to a question about something as innocuous as weather or sports, because there's...
No, but that's this...
Go ahead. I'm getting the impression from my understanding of the record that what really happened here is that the police officer has a routine, and that part of the routine is that he tends to ask people, you have any kids? Because... In his view, that's a kind of generic, you know, non-inflammatory kind of question that, you know, gets people thinking about something else while he's doing what he has to do. I mean, isn't that pretty much what the record sets forth?
Yes, Your Honor. It's to
okay.
try to...
Right. So the point here is that what this police officer generally uses as a kind of a throwaway question that's not significant and not supposed to be inflammatory and nose, so on, he used in this case where maybe it wasn't such a good choice of questions. So that even though in as a general rule it might make sense to consider a question like that totally innocuous and similar to saying, you know, gee, it's hot out today, or don't you think the weather's hot, that as it happens, an otherwise innocuous question has more significance given the kind of case this is. I mean, wouldn't that be a fair way of looking at it?
Your Honor, if the officer had reason to believe, certainly, that there had been children in the house, that children had been involved, that they had seen it, that would certainly be a much, much closer call. There's nothing to suggest that, and in fact, there were no children in the house. The children in this case are adult children. And obviously there were no children, you know, at the scene. Corporal Kraft did not have any reason to believe that by saying that on something that is sort of a kind of a universal sort of safe subject to talk about.
But let's go back to this case. Officer Kraft knows the person has invoked his Miranda rights. He said, I don't want to talk to the police. I prefer to remain silent. And Officer Kraft knows he's charged with attempting to kill his wife. I assume that Officer Kraft should think about the questions before he asks questions to a person who doesn't want to answer any questions. And if he had thought about this, wouldn't he have said to himself, gosh, I wonder if they had children, and I'll bet if he had children, this has got to be pretty upsetting for the whole family, so I'm not going to ask him about children. But maybe he seems a little upset. Maybe I'll ask him about his hobbies. Shouldn't he have gone through that thought process? Or is it just simply, well, you know, I know he doesn't want to talk to me, but I always chat people up, so I'm just going to chat with this person about his children.
Your Honor, I don't believe the record reflects that there was any extensive thought process about it. It was simply Officer Kraft's routine, his way of making sure the fingerprints were more easily conducted. I mean, a person can certainly cooperate by putting their finger out for fingerprinting, but if they are physically tense, it's not easy to roll that individual's finger.
But what's the significance of invoking your Miranda rights? If you say, I would like to exercise my right to remain silent, what's supposed to happen after that?
Then the police should not engage in custodial interrogation, and that did not happen in this case.
If we assume for a moment that the statement should not have been admitted, is there a basis for arguing harmless error?
Your Honor, certainly the fact that Mr. Aries himself called 911 to report the shooting, that he also called one of his colleagues at the Delaware Psychiatric Center and again recounted the fact that he shot at least Alvin Davis. There's nothing kind of extra that comes out of this statement. In one sense, entering this statement is in some ways duplicative of some of Mr. Aries' other admissions by way of the phone call before the police arrive. So in that sense, yes, that would be the short answer to your question, yes. Sorry. I guess if I may.
So you're saying everything that's in the statement came in independently of the statement, that the statement really added nothing to the state's case?
Your Honor, I don't want to say it added absolutely nothing. It certainly...
Well, tell us what was added, because as you know, in a harmless error analysis, we have to conclude that notwithstanding the inadmissible evidence, we can state beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless because the result would be the same. So if there's a difference, what we need to focus on is the fact that the difference was insignificant. I mean, difference between what's in the statement and the state's evidence without the statement.
Yes, Your Honor. The I'm assuming we're not talking about the fact of him saying that he has any children, because that's not, that doesn't really go to anything in the case. That's the predecessor to
What was in the statement was identical to the state's other evidence, and you said not exactly. So I assume when you answered not exactly, you had something in your mind that was in the statement that wasn't in the rest of the state's case.
I believe the statement about the children, the existence, acknowledging the existence of children, is something that would not have been in the case where when he calls the 911 and when he calls DPC.
Right, but to the extent that we're focusing on the contents of the statement that would be material to the charge, what, if anything, is new in the statement? That is, can you identify whether there is some differentiating element that, but for the statement, would not be in the record?
Your Honor, he acknowledges what he tells his boss. Again, that should be something that's, I can't say verbatim the same, but substantially similar to what he says to a supervisor at DPC. I guess it would be the very last portion of the statement, whether Mr. Davis made any movement towards him. That comes out after the at booking with Corporal Kraft. I don't believe that whether Davis made any movement towards him was something that he made any statement to in either the 911 call or the call to his supervisor at DPC.
Where you've now identified a portion of the defendant's statement, that is out-of-court statement, to the effect that Mr. Davis was coming toward him?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is that the only identified difference, or are there others?
Your Honor, I believe that is the only one.
So, and you're working with the statement as it's reproduced in the opening brief on page 8, or as it's found on A33?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that part of the statement was probably helpful to the defendant.
I would certainly say so, Your Honor. That I would not say that helped the state's case. That would, but that certainly came in as part of it.
What are your thoughts on the second issue?
Yes, Your Honor. The first, despite appellant's argument, this intent was the central issue in this case. The fact that in opening statements, Mr. Arie's trial counsel, in one sense, conceded that a shooting had taken place did not mean the state had no burden to prove the element of intent in the charges. That just meant there was no stipulation between the parties that, oh, yes, Mr. Arie's intentionally committed the shooting. And the fact that Arie's presented the EED defense, yes, that's certainly relevant, and that was, again, as Superior Court found, that's what this case turned on. I think it's critical to know. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just trying to put what I think you're saying into different words. There's racial animus involved in that portion of the statement. And you're saying that racial animus could be relevant to show intent, that is, a purposeful intent to kill Mr. Davis.
Yes, and it's not so much the racial animus as the contempt for the victims. And it's Mr. Arie's expression of that contempt by selecting a word to most forcefully to go along with his act of shooting. Because first he fires two shots into Mr. Davis' body, And then as he fires the third one, he leans over and uses the racial epithet for the first time. And then after he has then shot his wife, and then leaves the room after that, first having attacked her with the machete and then leaving the room again, he's then shouting back to her more of the racial obscenities. It was not so much, there's certainly no suggestion that he selected his victim based on the race. It's to...
What was unclear in this case from the state's perspective? He came home and he found his wife in bed with another man, and he armed himself and he started shooting them both multiple times. And what else did the state need? Why did it need these specific statements to what was missing from the state's case? You could see if you had encountered somebody in a different situation, but when you find them, your wife and somebody else in bed together, and you start shooting them both multiple times, what did the state think was missing that this statement would fill in the blank on?
Well, Your Honor, these were the exact words that Mr. Aries used, and to try to ask the witness to somehow sanitize that, it takes away from conveying what was going on at that moment. It just, to somehow craft that testimony to say, well, Ms. Aries, you can testify that, come up with some other word, that he fired the gun and simultaneously said something highly negative and derogatory about the other victim. It doesn't...
You're saying the racial epithet was evidence of cold fury. Is that correct? And there's no way to sugarcoat that.
Yes, Your Honor. It was just, he'd fired the two shots, and then the third one was truly, an execution in that sense. It was, this is the absolute contempt I have for this human being, and I'm expressing it with this language. And that's, I can stand here and say, not actually use the words myself today, and it certainly is not going to come across as powerfully as it does when the actual words are used. But that said, the state in no way intended to inject race into it. It was just the facts were what they were. They didn't raise this. They didn't play up on it in either openings or closings. It was not such as in Weddington or Flutiotis attempting to dirty up the defendant with something else. These statements were made during the course of the crime, immediately during the crime, and within a few minutes thereafter. It was very much tied into the facts of the crime. I see that my time is just about up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I just want to address the court's questions with respect to the harmless error analysis with the Miranda statement, or the lack of Miranda statement. Just to make it clear, A49 and A49, the police gave a rendition of what Mr. Ayers said at the scene, which we concede was a spontaneous utterance. And then A33 gives the statement with respect to what he said after being asked about his children. He told the police on the scene, "I'm sorry for what happened. I came home and heard voices, got the gun, and shot them after I saw them hugging each other." That's significantly different than what he said to police, that he was suspicious that something was happening. He went to work. He told his boss, "I got to go home," and he intended to go in and scare them, and then the lunging part comes in. So I would suggest, while that one little part of a sentence may have somewhat been helpful, this whole statement adds significantly to what he said earlier, showing a calm, collected state of mind, and would go significantly to rebutting the defendant's EED defense. Also, what I think is significant is after losing the suppression motion, the very next day, docket item 39, Ms. Van Amaragan withdrew her request for self-defense instruction, so it clearly affected what defense could be produced at trial. And finally, real quick, with respect to the racial epithet, the very fact that Neither Mr. Smith, nor I, nor anyone in this courtroom was willing to say that word today clearly indicates the inflammatory nature of it, clearly indicates that it was such significantly prejudice that substantially outweighed its marginal relevance. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.